Let me share a portion of one of the passages noted there, the first six verses of the 137th Psalm. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the willows we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. May the Lord add a blessing to the reading and hearing of his word. Let me tell you a little bit about my week. On Tuesday morning, like millions of Americans, I, along with Julie and our oldest daughter, Lauren, exercised our franchise, hard fought for, valiantly won over the years, oftentimes in our history opposed for people like me and my family by the laws of the state, but nevertheless now having full enfranchisement, we voted. And then a little later on Tuesday, I had been invited to a gathering at the Jacob Javits Center. And Julie and I made our way down, and I was fortunate and I suppose in a sense privileged to have access. We were probably no further from the main podium that ultimately didn't get used that night. No closer, or I should say no further than here I stand from the middle of the church aisle here. Of course, we all know what transpired that evening. The next morning, I was previously scheduled many, many weeks prior to either the election or what the outcome would be, to speak to a group of students at Jewish Theological Seminary. So I found myself on Wednesday morning starting out by sharing with about 30 rabbinical students. It was the end of a three-hour class. I was there for the last hour of a three-hour class. And for those previous 2 hours, it was evident when I walked into the room, as I saw puffed and tear-stained eyes, that they had been sharing in lament and regret all through that morning. And then I went back across the street to Union Theological Seminary, where we were holding not only a chapel service, but then following the chapel service, a special gathering of the community, for people to do two things. I think first and foremost to be in community, but then also even therapeutically to share with one another and to be mutually supportive, of course. And then, thanks be to God, had the privilege of gathering here on Wednesday evening, and I'm so thankful for what occurred early on Wednesday morning, just the conversation that sort of took place over exchanged emails, to think that it might make sense and it might be a good thing for us to provide for the opportunity for members to come and friends to come and again to share and be in community. And truly, I must tell you, that was time, certainly as I see it, that was well spent and a true blessing. I hope all of you who were here with us gained as much as I did just from being able to be mutually supportive and prayerful together. So, and then subsequent to, of course, those immediate days, as no doubt all of us know, there's been a lot of back and forth conversation, or I should say, just not speculation, but thinking about how the world will now unfold, because it is indeed a very, very, very different place. And let me preface this to say this. You know, I've been immersed in the political realm for many, many a year. This is so different than, you know, my team losing and another team winning. This is so different than just the normal kind of political back and forth conversation that people have. And I just want to make sure, I don't know if there's somebody here, or certainly if you know people who are wondering, well, why are people still vexed, and why don't they just get over it? How come they're still angry and sad that someone they didn't support won the election? And I'll tell you why. Because if you're black like me, you hear talk of law and order and stop and frisk, and remember a racially charged perspective that victimized unfairly young African-American men and others with impunity. You see the fact that the Ku Klux Klan is waging a celebratory march because of who won the presidential election. How foul, how foul. If you're Muslim, you worry that being spat in the face is now okay, and violations of your rights to assemble and your rights to privacy are about to potentially come to an end. If you're LGBTQ, you worry not only the potential loss of rights or restaurants gaining the right not to serve you, but by way of the vice president-elect, an administration that thinks it's more important to research electrocuting the gay out of you rather than addressing AIDS. If you're Hispanic and Latino, many are frightened that their children will be bullied in schools and their families ripped apart while their culture is mocked. And if you are a woman, maybe you're wondering now if we have normalized groping, and if your career endeavors will be judged by whether or not you're on the scale of a 1 to a 10. And it would be a different thing if all of this was simply conjecture on my part or opinion on my part. All I'm doing with you right now is sharing with you the sentiments that have been expressed by the individual who now will hold the highest office in the land. It's mournful that those are the realities that now are faced, and it's mournful that those are the things that cause people to be fearful and therefore don't say to somebody that you should get over the very things that have not even fully manifested themselves yet, but have been promised over and over and over again by way of the last year and a half of what we've heard and what we've seen. And then something else that's particularly mournful, as we were singing Onward Christian Soldiers, it struck me in the hymn where it says, we are not divided, all one body we. 81% of white evangelicals determined that it was better to vote for somebody who they probably would not even allow in their membership, and certainly not to be an officer on any of their church boards, to be president of the United States. And I call to account those evangelical leaders, even the person who oversees this effort. I call to account Franklin Graham. I call to account Jerry Falwell Jr. I call to account James Jeffers in Dallas. I call to account all of those who thought it was easier to compromise a consistency of Christian faith to allow for a political agenda. So, that's where we are. And again, as I say all of this, I feel liberated because, you know, I think I talked in the past about 501c3 stipulations and all of those concerns about being politically engaged in the context of the church. Well, that really is no longer relevant because we're no longer talking about a political campaign or a political candidate. We're talking about the government of the United States as it is and as it will be in yet a few short weeks. So, yes, and God help me as I say this, you know, whether or not everybody here agrees with me or not, I don't care. Because I'm not expressing this born out of, again, an ideological or a political stance. My concerns and my fears and trepidations are born again. The one thing that you can do is take a person at their word, right? And if somebody says to you over and over and over again those things that we're talking about here now, all I can do is take them at their word. So when people say, well, give that person a chance, I'm going to say, well, am I giving them a chance to do what they've promised over and over again to do in the course of the next 4 years? And I think it's important because, again, and a lot of people, and I believe genuinely and sincerely and well-meaning people, have been saying, well, we need to have a measure of unity. We need to come together and we need to therefore unify and gather. And I don't disagree with the ultimate goal, of course, of unity. But let me just say this. If you think it is the default, or I should say the automatic place that we should go, consider this. That if you're calling for unity and reconciliation, if the only thing you want is in essence to kind of calm the waters, then that's not biblical reconciliation. Because you see, I can't be reconciled to somebody if they aren't willing to come into that space of reconciliation themselves. If that person is not willing to say it's wrong to foment nationalism, it's wrong to marginalize ethnic groups. It's wrong to do the dog whistle of racial politics. It's wrong to objectify women and say awful and foul things about them and to have a perspective, again, that is counter to anything that we hold by way of a moral standard. And so until an individual is willing to say that in the spirit of reconciliation, I need to come to that place where I understand that those things are wrong. As much as I might want to be reconciled to them, I can't be because they're not coming to be reconciled. See, and you have to be careful. And this will sound hyperbolic, but it's true. You can't just simply say, well, now we've had the electoral process and this individual is the duly elected holder of this office. It's interesting when I met with those rabbinical students on Wednesday. Part of the conversation was that, as you can imagine, some of their parents and grandparents had come here from Europe in the 30s and 40s. And they made the point that those individuals who were in leadership, the ones that they fled, had started out as duly elected. So there's not an inherent virtue because somebody has been elected into an office. Yes, we indeed thank God for the process, the democratic process. But that doesn't compel us to put aside the concerns that we indeed have with those persons who hold those offices. And then let me also say this, that if we're called to our Christian duty, that Christian duty is not limited to simply, again, wrapping our arms around one another and making nice. Because you see, As much as you or I want the peaceability of that measure of unity, God also calls us to a prophetic word. Because the same Bible that we all read reminds us of people like Amos, reminds us of people like Daniel, reminds us of people like Esther, who understood what it meant to speak truth to power. So maybe what we need to be praying about right now is, yes, hoping and trusting and praying that in some way and in some fashion unity can come about, but what we may also need to be praying about, and this is where we talk about the way in which we sing our songs in Babylon, maybe we need to understand what it means to sing in a clear and consistent and sustained voice for what is right and just and godly. I think about 20th century saints, if you will, who understood that their call to be godly people meant that they had to stand against what was unjust. I think about a Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the midst of World War II, decided to go back from here in New York as a student at Union Seminary, to go back to Germany to stand in the face of oppression. Think about a Fannie Lou Hamer, who stood up by way of the Mississippi Freedom Party and stood against segregation and injustice, so much so that LBJ had to do all that he could to divert attention from her because of what she was saying and doing that was so powerful. Think of a Martin Luther King who sat in a Birmingham jail and told the clergy, who supported him on some level of moral ground, that, well, your pacifism, your moderation is not enough. So we need to understand this morning that if we are truly called to hear God speaking into this moment, yes, he's calling us to love. But he's calling us to express that love in ways that are faithful to the justice and mercy. In fact, in Micah, how simple can it get? What does God require of you? But to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. So. That means if we're called to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God, when we find the opposite unfolding, when we find injustice unfolding, when we find there to be a lack of mercy, and when we find there to be no humility, then it calls us to bear witness of those very things. And maybe some of the reason that folk are rushing to the idea of, okay, let's come together and let's get it all settled out and let's get over it is because that's easy. That's easy to say. But you and I are now living in a nation that is horrifically divided. It's divided, yes, it's divided along socioeconomic strata, but even more glaringly, it's divided along racial strata. There's a lack of charitableness in this conversation that will be damaging not only to this present moment, but for years to come. If we don't make certain that we stand in a sense of commitment to the higher purposes of God. Now here's the thing. Singing the songs of Zion in a Babylon moment, they don't have to be songs of opposition. I don't have to do and say things that are acrimonious to the president. No. What I'm called to do and what the children of Israel were called to do in this Babylon moment was to sing those songs that reminded them and bore witness of the presence and promise of God. So maybe our task, as it should have always been, but particularly now, maybe our task is by the work we do, by the witness we bear, to sing those songs to remind ourselves of God's faithfulness in the singing of those songs, and to bear witness in a world that oh so sorely needs it. So when we think about how to sing the songs of Zion, how to bear witness to God's goodness, even when it's difficult, even when it hurts, we understand that as we sing those songs, we do several incredibly important things. First of all, we allow God to minister to our hearts and to our spirits. The grief and the sorrow and the sense of loss is real. Again, like I said, this is not some simple political conversation. This is a real sense of foreboding. The fear is real. And again, based on what we've heard, what has been stated fervently. So singing the songs of Zion speaks into our spirits and in our hearts, and we're reminded of God's strength and God's faithfulness and God's love and God's mercy. But then singing those songs, when I say singing those songs, I mean standing for and working for what is right and just and being the church in our love and in our service and in our witness. It bears witness publicly, and it confounds those who would want to attack us. It helps them to realize that even in a moment like this, we anchor on to a God whose faith is real and certain. Our hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. So, I apologize, not really, but I apologize by way of protocol that this isn't a typical three-point sort of, you know, homiletics class sermon. But I think it's important because I don't really know that any of you would be honest if you said that you weren't thinking about all of this in some fashion and in some ways. I know that even just by some of the conversations I had earlier this morning as we were getting ready to gather. And what I want to try to do is just simply say that even in this moment, God gives us a pattern. God gives us a mode of coping with and addressing this in the same way that the children of Israel were confounded in the despair of being in Babylon. They were reminded that even in those moments, they had every right and all the authority to sing of God's presence because God had not left nor abandoned them. But understand that when God doesn't leave us or abandon us, God doesn't allow for us to simply sit idly by either. But God calls us to the work of justice and mercy and love and standing for what is right and righteous. And there will be opportunities and there will be ways to do that in large scale measure and in small ways. In fact, one of the most heartening things this past week was the beginnings of conversation, and I know we'll flesh this out in the next several days, but of how we might extend ourselves in support and love to other members of our community who may, in a particular way, be feeling victimized and fearful about what the future will unfold. How do we extend ourselves in Christ-modeled love to them? And I'm going to be looking, I don't know about you, but I'm going to be looking for those ways and those opportunities going forth every day. So I'm thankful that Greenwood is an anomaly. I'm thankful that as we sit here, we are not reflective of the hard and difficult and deep chasm that is sadly very much a part of the American landscape and even more specifically a part of the landscape of the church. It confounds me that in the same nation, on the same Sunday morning, there are congregations where words and sentiments may not be dissimilar to what I'm sharing, but that also there are congregations where people are exultant and happy and elated about what has transpired. And the fact that two perspectives can be so different and seek to occupy the same kind of spiritual space is really confounding. And it means we've got reparative and restorative work that we need to be about. And the last thing I'll say is this. I understand. Everybody doesn't have to think like I think or have the perspective that I have. That's fine. That's one of the strengths of the United States of America, that there can be different and divergent opinions. But I also want to make sure that everybody is able to have a voice and that their voices aren't quieted in fear and their voices aren't quieted by being marginalized, that their voices aren't quieted because those in power and authority have exacted upon them what it is that they're going to do to them. I want to make sure that everybody has a place at the table. And I want to make sure that our Christian witness points to a transcendent God. If this was just about Democratic versus Republican politics, I wouldn't have spent even 2 minutes talking about this morning. But you and I know this is deeper, this is different. And so it calls us to dig deep. To dig deep. Listen, in the same way, you know, I've avoided national news pretty much since late Tuesday night. And yet here and there I've gotten glimpses of it, and I saw that meeting in the Oval Office. And the President Obama in these last several days, and of course in my estimation he has always exuded this, but I think, if anything, it would almost be a unanimous perspective on the part of most people that he has been the exemplary manifestation of being presidential. And I think, I don't know this, he and I don't talk early in the mornings on a regular basis, but I've got to believe he dug deep to be gracious, that he dug deep to engage with a man who denied his very legitimacy over and over and over and over again. So if the chief executive of the United States can express a measure of graciousness like that, that's the goal that we can assume or attain or work toward. But I just want to make sure that we don't presume that we can sit down or stand down. Charles Albert Tindley, who was a Methodist African-American minister who grew up in the Chesapeake area, he wrote a number of hymns, beautiful hymns, one of them called Beams of Heaven. And he said in that, "Wickedness a while may reign, and Satan's power may seem to gain, but there is a God who rules above with a hand of power and a heart of love." And I won't attribute, amen. I'm not attributing anything satanic to any particular person, certainly not the president-elect. What I am saying is this, that you and I both know, and you'd be dishonest with yourself if you didn't say this, you and I know that there is an ugliness that has risen and surfaced and has been whipped up. That's the wickedness that our witness can stand against. So it may feel like Babylon right now. It may feel like defeat right now. It may feel, even for a minute, if you're honest, Wisconsin made me feel pretty hopeless for a minute. But in the midst of all of that, we still can sing that God is faithful, that God heals, and that if we make ourselves available, God can indeed bring us together. You know, the beloved community, the fellowship of the saints, can overcome all of this if we are but true and faithful to the very God who will not leave us nor forsake us. Do justly. Love mercy. And walk. Walk together, children. Don't you get weary. Walk humbly with our God.